This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
See, this is something Democrats don't understand. Why is all politics moral? Because any political leader gets up there and says, here's what I think should be done, because it's the right thing to do. And that's the message that needs to be out there. And the conservatives know that message. They have that message all the time. We're acting on principle. It's the right thing to do in their moral system.
Last week on Sea Change Radio, influential progressive and cognitive linguist George Lakoff laid out the principles of linguistic framing as they relate to environmentalism. This week, part two of my discussion with Professor Lakoff, where we delve into the framing of topics such as genetically modified organisms, greenhouse gas emission legislation, and what's wrong with approaching ecological issues through a cost-benefit lens. If you can't get enough of Dr. Lakoff's insightful views and would like to hear some of the more politically focused parts of our discussion, go to seachangeradio.com and listen to our podcast exclusive. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by George Lakoff. He is the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. And he's the author of over a dozen books. His latest is The Little Blue Book, which he's co-authored with Elizabeth Vailing. George, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
A pleasure to be here.
You were talking about how the conservative brain tends to come from a more authoritarian and business world. I always thought that efficiency is something that gets left off the table as a term too much when I hear the environmentalist framing things, that we always have to assume that we need to use the same amount of energy or more, and that's a given. So how do we fill those energy needs? But it's never about using less and being more efficient with our use. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's a very good reason. You don't make money that way. The gas companies don't make money that way. And this is really, the point is a really important point. The slogan comes from Benjamin Franklin. A penny saved is a penny earned. You know, an erg saved is an erg earned, right? That is, every time you you have to use gas, like, you know, your car has more mileage, then you don't use less gas and you put less stuff in there. That is, if you fix up your buildings in cities to use less energy, that's the equivalent of not fixing it up and using more.
And I think one of the more important changes taking place in the efficiency / conservation movement is coming from this next generation, which is eschewing cars.
Yes.
They prefer their cell phones and on public transportation. They can be free in their own environment. Well, for the last 100 years in America, freedom meant that car where you get your driver's license, you're out on the American road, and you are free. But it's a different concept, I think, now.
It's a very different concept for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, you can rent a car more cheaply than own one, which is, you know, they understand that. But also, if you happen to be of a generation that's living in a metropolis where there is public transportation, where you can get to your job or work from home, in that way, then if you're in San Francisco or New York, you're better off without a car. You know, you use public transportation and that frees you there. If you want to go somewhere, it's cheaper to rent a car than to own one. You want to go somewhere for a weekend or 2 weeks or something, rent a car. It's cheaper than buying one and keeping it and maintaining it.
The average cost of a car for a year is $10,000.
Right. For $10,000, you can get a lot of car rental.
That's right.
You know, there are different forms of freedom.
So with that in mind, how do you think the environmental movement on the whole can improve its messaging?
There's a problem in the environmental movement, which is each environmental organization has different interests and a different audience. And the CEOs of those organizations have a fiscal responsibility to raise money for their organization. And so what they say is about raising money for their organization. And they can't get a common message across for that reason. They don't know how to work together in these cases.
Because they're competing for the same dollars in many cases.
They're competing for the same dollars.
Now, maybe focus on one example, if you will, where you think these organizations are screwing up, like in the contentious world of greenhouse gas reduction measures, like in a carbon tax or cap and trade.
NRDC decided to go for cap and trade. Why? Well, I've worked with NRDC, and I've worked with their major people, and I've worked at their conventions and so on. And they're wonderful, by the way, they're wonderful people and very, very competent. But the people running NRDC are scientists who are very good and lawyers who are very good and who work with politicians. So they work on legislation. But they're not people who know about framing things and people's brains. There are no cognitive scientists working for NRDC that I know. You know, when I first went for cap and trade, it was clear that this was a loser and that there was a better proposal. But the people there decided that they couldn't fight the energy companies and that they were going to have to make some, you know, problem go along with them. But they didn't understand how conservatives think and what they would have to face. They didn't get that at all. And they didn't get what they would have to face in terms of, they didn't have a system of communication, and they didn't have all of the people saying the same thing. At the same time, there was an excellent proposal that had been made first by Peter Barnes and later in the CLEAR Act that has been proposed, is still out there in the Senate. And the idea is this behind it, the CLEAR Act. It says, it asks the question, who owns the air? Well, you own the air. Okay, we all own the air. Well, if we own the air, what's happening is that people who own oil companies and coal companies and so on are selling a product that is putting their junk in the air. They're not cleaning up after themselves. Normally, a business is supposed to pay for the costs of doing business. You know, if you produce junk, you're supposed to be paid to get rid of the junk, you know, and recycle it or do whatever, but to get rid of your junk. But their junk that they're putting out is carbon dioxide, and they're not doing anything to stop it. They have a product that is poisoning the air, and they're not even paying dumping fees. So the proposal was to have a trust set up, not the government, to issue dumping permits, to dump a certain amount of carbon dioxide in the air per year. And in order to sell fuel in the country, the fuel is, there's only like, you know, a couple of thousand outlets for gas and coal and so on in the country. They're already monitored by computer. You know exactly how much gasoline, coal, et cetera, is sold in what part of the country by each of these outlets. And you know how much carbon dioxide is put out. So you say, okay, if you want to put out so many tons of carbon dioxide from your fuel, you have to buy a dumping permit for this. There's a lower price. But then you can create a market in that. You can trade dumping permits if you like and go back and forth. But the money from this goes into a trust fund. And that trust fund does the following with the money. It gives 3/4 of it back to every individual every month by bank transfer, every citizen. And the first year it would start out with a family of four, about $1,500, and then go up. The rest of the money would be used to promote alternative energy. Okay? And then each year what would happen is fewer and fewer permits would be given. Until after, you know, 30 or 40 years, you'd be down to, you know, you'd gradually cut the amount of pollution year by year, and it would be predictable. So every industry that depended on these things would know to move to alternative energy bit by bit over a number of years. So it's predictable and so on. And the government wouldn't touch it. It would be entirely a trust. And the money every month goes to people, like they do in Alaska. Now, beautiful plan. Got nowhere.
Why?
The environmentalists didn't support it. They went for cap and trade. Cap and trade was a 2,000-page impossible plan that was nuts. And it was could never possibly have worked. And no one could understand it anyway. This is simple to understand, easy to do. And not only that, it costs nothing to administer because it can all be done by computer. Funds get transferred by computer. Permits get issued by computer. Everything's monitored by computer. It costs virtually nothing to monitor this, to administer this. Beautiful plan, and it's still there. It's sitting in Congress. It's before Congress, never been in the Senate, rather, never been voted on.
What's it called again?
The CLEAR Act. Now, this is something that could be done today. But it's not even been discussed. The environmental movement never went out and said, we need the CLEAR Act. We need the CLEAR Act. This is how we do it. Government wouldn't have touched this. You'd get money. Now, well, the criticism from the right wing was, this is the equivalent, the economic equivalent of a tax on gas.
Which is a third rail in politics for some strange reason.
Right. And the answer to that is, that's only an economic equivalent. It's not a cognitive equivalent. People will understand it as getting money. Because they will be getting checks in the rail.
It's a rebate.
It's a rebate, no, but they don't even have to send in for it. They just get it automatically. They will get money, not give money. And that is all the difference in the world.
Listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace. Just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with UC Berkeley linguistics professor George Lakoff.
I remember having this conversation with a conservative friend of mine, and he had a spill on the floor, and he grabbed the paper towels and he was like, my girlfriend always says, you know, why don't you use a rag? And I always tell her I make enough money to buy paper towels. So why shouldn't I be able to use paper towels? So that message might not work with somebody like that. They're under that brain. Their brain is functioning like I earned money that could pay for this cause and effect and not thinking in a systemic sense.
Right.
Just being conscious of this goes such a long way, too. And so, like, even if it comes from the conservative side, it doesn't matter. It should be a bipartisan issue that we should be using less.
Yeah. But the thing is that it's political as well. See, this is where Al Gore screwed up. Love Al Gore. Have had lots of arguments with Al Gore. And he had this wonderful movie, An Inconvenient Truth. Well, that wasn't a great title either. Negative, inconvenient.
Right, right.
Right. You know, wasn't just the truth. You know.
That might have sounded a little more religious.
But you see, what happened there was this. There was a great moment in that film. There's the pivotal moment in that film that really worked. Was when he was the professor and he had these two graphs and the graphs were going up and they were going off the charts and he had to go up, you know, to follow the graph and then you could see the parallelism and so on. That was the moment of the film.
I agree.
And then he screwed up. And the way he screwed up was, after that, it was all about personal responsibility. you know, you need to use less energy at home. You need to, you know, walk instead of drive, bicycle, blah, blah, blah. You know, all of those things.
What do people really want to hear? They want to hear what George Bush told them after 9/11. Go out and shop.
Right. That's right. And they want, but you see, they also want to hear that they are going to get a check in the mail from the companies for using less gas.
That you have a vested interest in seeing them right. stop their behavior.
Stop their behavior. And not only that, he of all people should have known that political action was important. That this is a moral issue and that all politics is moral. See, this is something Democrats don't understand. Why is all politics moral? Because any political leader gets up there and says, here's what I think should be done because it's right, not because it's wrong. Nobody gets up and says, do what I say because it's wrong. It's evil, but do it. Or it doesn't matter, but do it.
Yeah, whenever I hear a politician say that, because it's the right thing to do, and that's a pretty powerful message.
That's the message, because it's the right thing to do. And that's the message that needs to be out there. And the conservatives know that message. They have that message all the time. We're acting on principle. It's the right thing to do in their moral system. But you see, the progressives don't understand their own moral system. And they don't talk about their moral system because they think everything is about issues and policies. Because they think if you just tell people the facts, they'll reason to the right conclusion. Now, they're getting better at this. The last Democratic National Convention was framed well. You heard Bill Clinton do a great job. You heard Elizabeth Warren do a great job. The president did a pretty good job. You had lots of terrific speeches there that were well framed because their speechwriters have started to seep through. You see it more in Obama's recent speeches. They're slowly getting in, it's getting in there. The question is, you know, it's not just the speechwriters, it's also Obama himself. And they need to do better. They can do better, they're doing somewhat better. They need to do a lot better. And they need to have a system of communication. The Republicans are doing very well at their system of communication.
Which is anti-Obama.
Which is anti-Obama is seen as, you know, pro-conservatism. That is, it's the whole idea is to defend and extend conservatism itself. So by being against, I think they don't understand that by using negation, they're helping Obama. See, they're making the don't think of an elephant mistake, which is an interesting thing to see.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm joined by UC Berkeley linguistics professor George Lakoff. You've written, buying senators is more effective than buying new light bulbs. Effective communication can buy political leaders by changing what voters hear. Ecological moral action is fundamentally political action. Now, can you relate that to the criticism that Jimmy Carter underwent when he wore a cardigan around the White House and tried to set an example? Why was that a mistake?
Because it was a hair shirt move.
What does that mean?
Hurt yourself. Sacrifice. And the whole point here is it ain't sacrifice. You see, there's a lot of people who say, oh, I'm more moral because I'm bicycling. You want to be comfortable in your home, and you can wear a sweater to be comfortable. Not because of this other thing.
Even if it is the right thing to do.
Even if it is the right, and you might want to say it's the right thing to do, so I'll wear a sweater, but it's because it's the right thing to do. It's not just for practical reasons, and it's not just personal responsibility, you're going to wear a sweater. You know, this is about, the idea of having solar energy in the White House. It's about solar energy everywhere. If Carter really wanted it, what he should have done was to have every army base be powered by solar cells, not just the White House. The White House is symbolic, so what? You know, if every base had been powered by solar cells, you'd have a lot of saving of that. But not only that, you'd have people in the army trained as technicians. People going out of the army say, hey, solar cells work, etc. And this is something that ought to be done throughout the military.
And you always hear how sunlight is the best disinfectant, and that bullet point number one for progressives is tell the truth.
Yes.
I thought it was a pretty interesting debate this last fall in Prop 37, the GMO labeling debate.
Right.
They framed it in a very interesting way where it was all about a consumer's right to know. It's not about whether or not GMOs are good or bad in their framing. It was about, shouldn't you know what you're feeding your family? It didn't pass, but I thought it was kind of a very cleverly crafted campaign.
Well, that's right. It was. And they didn't know how to respond to the other side. And they needed to.
But then the other side in the Prop 37 was saying, it's going to raise your food bill, $400. And that's all people needed to hear, even though it was complete lunacy, that adding a little bit to a label saying this is going to, that was somehow going to add to your cost.
And that's wrong.
Oh, it was a lie, but it was an effective lie.
But no, our guys didn't say it. Our guys didn't say it will keep, you know, it will improve your health and, you know, it will improve everybody's health. And it won't raise it. Not, you don't deny it. You say it will keep food bills the same if the companies get rid of the GMOs, right? It'll keep food bills the same. Don't listen to Monsanto. You know, Monsanto is lying to you. The point is that they needed to have a devil, and they didn't have one. They needed a bad guy, and they didn't have it. You're right to know, and it'll keep them the same. You'll only gain from this. Who will lose? The bad guy who's telling you this lie.
They didn't expose the bad guy.
They didn't expose the bad guy and fight him. See, they needed to fight the bad guy from the beginning. And they needed to say, and they needed a commercial to say, what's wrong with it? See, instead of just saying, we don't know about GMOs, that's not good enough. You got to say, you know, what's really true. And not only that, GMOs are killing off farmers all over the world.
Sure.
You know, it's not. See, they didn't give the moral message. It wasn't just right to know.
It'll raise your food bill $400 is a moral message
a
to
moral
somebody
message.
Who's a single mom who's trying to feed
right.
their family.
And the answer is no. It'll only cut the profits. It'll only raise your food bill if Monsanto keeps
decides out, to raise the food
decides
bill.
To raise the price of food.
Right.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to UC Berkeley linguistics professor George Lakoff. So it seems pretty apparent that a lot of these major corporations are not paying the cost of doing business. But if we did a cost-benefit analysis of how they approach environmental issues, why would environmentalists actually be losing in that framing? Why is cost-benefit analysis a loser for environmentalists?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the cost of doing business. Normally, if you do business and there's a waste product from your business, you have to pay to get rid of that. If you are doing steel and there are steel tailings, you got to get rid of them somehow. You know, it's your job to do that. But for fossil fuel companies, they're putting out poisons in the air, carbon dioxide and other chemicals. And therefore, they're not paying the cost of doing business. We're paying it for it with, you know, terrible weather and the change in the environment and all of the bad things that go with that. We're paying for that. In addition to that, the cost-benefit analysis idea is a disaster, and it's not understood as such. Because you have, there's a metaphor involved as if costs and benefits were just neutral things. But cost-benefit analysis is a mathematical theory, and most people don't know that.
And you say it's inherently anti-ecological.
It's anti-ecological, and let me explain why. There's an equation used in that, and you have to understand what that equation means. A cost-benefit analysis is what is called an integral. It's a sum over the following things. You take all of The first thing you have to do is put everything in economic terms. So if there's some environmental thing, you have to give it a cost or a benefit. You have to say what does it cost or what benefit do you get from this environmental thing, whatever it is, okay? Which is hard to do, and some people try to give monetary values to things like wetlands and so on. Say, well, wetlands filter water, so that's the equivalent of building a water plant that filters water. But it's not. Then there's cost-benefit analysis. Should we save the wetland, or should we let them fill it in, build a hotel, and have a water filtration plant? Okay? Well, let's ask that question from a cost-benefit analysis point of view. What does that mean? There's an equation. It says we're going to take the benefit of keeping the wetland minus the cost of keeping the wetland, and it's one thing. It's not part of a system. It's isolated. Over a period of time, you got to take, because in order to calculate a cost, you have to take a beginning point and an end point.
How much is that wetland worth today, and how much is it going to be worth in 50 years?
In 50 years or 25 years, however, right? There's got to be an end point. But when you have that equation in there, there's a term. And the reason the term is e to the minus dt. What does that mean? D is a discount rate. Why? It's the rate because money gets less expensive with time. So as you know, if you put $100 in an investment, and you get $100 back 10 years from now, you're not going to be happy. And it's compound interest, so it's exponential. Well, what that means is that the money that's saved in a cost benefit analysis goes down each year. That is, it's e to the minus discount rate times time, so the money that's saved goes down each year, and after a small amount of time, that approaches zero.
So long-term planning out the window.
Long-term planning out the window. Cost-benefit analysis is made up for companies who have short-term profits in mind.
3 to 5 years before the CEO has to take his golden parachute or get fired or whatever.
Yeah, or the stock has to go up in a certain amount of time.
Right.
That's when cost-benefit analysis is for. You know, it's sort of, as we're worried about our short-term profits over a certain number of years. You know, do we make this decision or that decision? Here are the benefits of this. Here are the costs of this. Let's compute them. Fine. Okay, works there. Anything to do with the environment, it will not work.
Would it be fair to draw this analogy? We were talking about systemic risk versus local risk. That's more like in a spatial sense, but this is like the time equivalent of it, versus the future risk?
Exactly. It's the time equivalent of that. Nature doesn't end. Wetlands should be there forever.
Doesn't have a value.
It doesn't have a value that you can compute over 5 years. Yeah, and you can judge. It's not like that. It's not that kind of thing. So the idea of using cost benefit analysis for environmental issues is a terrible mistake.
UC Berkeley linguistics professor George Lakoff. People can go to georgelakoff.com to learn more. George, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Hot Chocolate, Joe Henry, and Grandmaster Flash.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.